Hello, everybody. So glad you could join us. This is Yolanda Calderon welcoming you to Healthy Body, Vibrant Life, a telesummit to discover simple techniques to feel more alive, energized, and happy in your body. I am a heart math and lifestyle coach and have been a health educator and body worker for over a decade. Fitness for me is not just about having an exercise routine. Most often my fitness has come through some type of dance or play, or because I love to walk wherever I'm going. My purpose with this summit is not only to dispel the myth that getting fit and happy in your body has to be hard work, but also to encourage you to find health, joy, and even playfulness through all different kinds of movement. The exceptional people I've been interviewing in this series all have their unique ways of inspiring you to find joy in moving your body as well as your energy. My next guest has dedicated her career to bringing together mind and body. Dr. Eileen Serlin is a psychologist and a dance movement therapist in San Francisco and Marin County. She's a fellow of the American Psychological Association and past president of the San Francisco Psychological and the Humanistic Psychological Associations. She has been practicing dance therapy since 1973 and clinical psychology since 1985. She's earned great respect in the dance therapy community and writes about the psychological aspects of movement and body language. She has been a folk dancer and enjoyed teaching and training different movement styles around the world. Welcome to the summit, Dr. Eileen. It's so wonderful to get to talk to you.
Thank you, Yolanda. You also. I look forward to this.
Great. So, Dr. Eileen, I'm going to start with a question about the concept. Everyone has a unique movement signature. Could you explain that for me? I think it's very intriguing.
Wonderful. Yes. Thank you. It's something that's interested me for a long time. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I was always mimicking other people, and noticed that I could tell who was who by the way they walked into a room or so forth. And then in my dance therapy thesis was on gender differences in movement. Can you have a feeling it's a woman as you see somebody at a distance walking down the street, or a man, or the way they sit and so forth, and just kind of analyzing movement style. We then studied a marvelous tool for movement observation called Laban notation, named after Rudolf von Laban, who, until he invented this system, there was no system for notating dance, nothing systematic as we have music for writing music. Dance was made with little pictures of feet and hands and so forth. Laban developed something based on time, weight, space, and flow, and dynamics and space harmonics. It's a very complicated, very subtle system which is used to notate not just dance, so historic dances can be archived, but also everyday movement style of people. It's been used, one of his students used it after World War II to look at efficiency on assembly lines. It gets used for all kinds of things, but some of the studies that interested me enormously were on mother-child interactions, and they saw that children from birth on, and then later on even in utero, have distinctive movement styles, which are like their signature or thumbprint, that are remarkably mostly stable over time. They're stable, and also these movement styles change according to certain developmental styles. We go through what some psychoanalysts call sort of psychodynamic styles. But basically, we have a recognizable style. We're also influenced by mood and by other people, so we change how we move when we're depressed or we're excited. Obviously, still, there's something recognizable over time. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I noticed as a folk dancer back in the 70s, 60s, I was folk dancing and then lived in Istanbul for a month and teach in China. You can't imagine more different cultural ways of moving. So we have influences of gender, of culture, of age, and yet there is also something distinctively human about each one of us that can be read just like a thumbprint over time.
Even from the time that we're embryos?
It was called at that point Sands Point Developmental Center in Long Island outside of New York. They were I guess doing filming, I suppose, even in utero, the embryo not only has a heartbeat, but is moving. And they were able to kind of graph the mother-child interaction and looking at, some have a very obviously harmonious relationship. Others, you can already see conflict between two different styles. And then you can see how they grow up, what they do in this developmental center. We saw films of mothers who were very anxious about holding their children and or ambivalent about childbirth, and they were holding the children kind of stiffly or awkwardly. You can kind of see the lack of harmony start growing between the two of them. At the developmental center, they have play groups, you mentioned that, and groups where they actually teach not just mothers but fathers how to play with their children, how to attune. We talked about attunement a little bit, you and I, and we can talk again about it, but mirroring and copy, these are all nonverbal communication styles that happen at a very early age. We can see them in our relationship to animals, but it is the same with babies, this mirroring that's really essential for their development.
Wow, so as a dance therapist and a psychologist, if you can identify someone's movement signature, you can, and if say they're having problems in the world, then you can help them find more ease in the world by addressing their movement?
Absolutely. Now, the first step we had to go through in our training, which is interesting, when you're training to be a psychologist, psychotherapist, you often have to go through your own analysis, psychoanalysis, or at least in the old days you did, that is to be able to know what's you and what's the patient. So if you know your own preferences or strengths or weaknesses, you don't impose them on somebody else. So in our movement analysis, I learned, for example, that I'm very at home moving through space, lots of space. I like to move around at parties, dance on a big floor. Other people sort of stick to one spot, make a home base and stick to it. So all these things are very distinctive, but I have to learn that if I'm moving with someone in a dance therapy session, I don't automatically assume they want to move through space. So you have to learn yourself in order to separate yourself out of the situation and really tune into the other person as that person is and help that person identify and augment his or her own style and not overwhelm it with your own style or your own preferences.
Everyone gets to exercise their own way, moving from the inside out.
Oh, that's the whole point of it, is that in a sense we all have to get out of our own way, whether it's the chatter in our minds about the way we're supposed to be or move or look, or as a therapist about trying to fix anybody. We have to get all of that out of the way, and then we just function as a sense of mirrors, nonverbal mirrors, where we reinforce and support and help give birth to whatever style is trying to come out from underneath all the overlay of thinking and right versus wrong that we tend to do to ourselves.
That's wonderful. So that actually brings me to my next question, which I think I might know the answer to, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there a right or a wrong way to move?
You know, if you ask that in general, I would say the answer is yes, because we have a lot of emphasis on, let's say, posture and yoga. You and I know about that. And sure, there are ways to move where you don't hurt your body, you don't overextend yourself. So if you're focusing on function, the answer is yes. But if you're focusing on expression more as we do, then the answer is no. And the whole point is to undo a lot of habitual ways we move. I mean, in the old days, before your time, Yolanda, girls were taught to sit with their legs kind of crossed at the ankle, and kind of you wore skirts and you sat demurely. You didn't sprawl. You didn't stride down the street. So there are a lot of things we learned about how we were supposed to show up in the world that have really inhibited a lot of us. And so that's kind of what we try to do, is undo that learned learning, which is not natural for the person, and let the natural emerge. And it's hard to find our own natural. We've all had a lot of conditioning about what we're supposed to be. But it's very exciting when the real self starts coming out.
So if you take the chains off, so to speak, suddenly you might find that you're moving in a whole different way.
Well, that's what got me into it, too, besides being a folk dancer. I'm pretty good verbally, and I find that with lots of people who are good verbally, movement is less defended. We don't have our stories quite as clear as we do when we tell our verbal stories about who we think we are, who we're told we always were. But movement, what's one of the things that's so delightful is you find yourself moving in surprising ways. You might have an inner wild child who's been wanting to come out, or you might have a seductive side or something. And it often comes out. I use music, all kinds of things to elicit parts of the personality. And surprise is the key to the fact that something authentic is emerging.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Mm. So, Dr. Eileen, how is movement, or how does movement affect the mind?
And of course they go back and forth. The mind affects the body. We've talked about, we could probably talk about that more than we do about how movement affects the mind. So I'll sort of say what it is and what it's not. What it really isn't is, and there's some apps that do this now and so forth, like if you're depressed and kind of not breathing and hunched over, well, then just sit up straight, take some deep breaths, and you can't be depressed and sitting upright at the same time. And so sort of fake it till you make it, change your posture. There's a TED talk on that recently, you know, walk with more power and you'll feel more power. That's true, but it's also very manipulative. And we would rather that come organically. So kind of if you're depressed and slumped over, it may be that you get mindful of that. How do you really feel depressed? Really feel what you're doing. Oh, I'm holding my breath. Oh, I'm slumping over. Oh, yes, this is how I walk when I'm sad about something or other. Then you can exaggerate it, really feel it. And then you can begin to look for its opposite, because a lot of movement happens in pairs of opposites, the polarities. So if you concave, you try being convex, and you go back and forth until you get more conscious awareness of where you are on that continuum. And it gives you more freedom of choice. You can say to yourself, I'm not really depressed, but I'm just sitting in that, it's like my security blanket. I think, you know, I actually, you know, have worked with some people whose story is that they're sort of sad. And when they're alone, they kind of go into the sad, poor me, victim, whatever it is. And it's mostly just habitual thinking about who I am, kind of afraid to be liberated, afraid to be powerful, afraid to be. So when you take on a position, you evoke the story that goes with that position that you've always told yourself or others have told you. So the point is not to just change it, but the point is to become more aware of the relationship between the inner story and the outer action. And ultimately, what we aim for is congruence, that you are your thinking, your emotions, your fantasies, your outer actions, the way people see you are all one and the same every moment, that there's integrity, which means one.
Right.
And
so,
people have choice.
Right. So instead of putting a smiley face sticker on your sadness, you get to acknowledge how you're feeling and then change it from there.
And discover your own ways of changing it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's a lot nicer way or a more efficient way of approaching it, as opposed to, I think a lot of new agey people kind of think, oh, you're sad, well, just, you know, start smiling and you're going to be happy. But but it's not that simple. It's a little more complicated than that, right?
Well, you've used the word, I think, authentic, or, you know, your unique stuff. We both are talking about movement from within. So if somebody's imposing a change on you, that may work in the short run, but in the long run, you're still dependent on somebody else to do it for you. So the point of this is to evoke your own inner wisdom about what your body is doing and expressing, and what your mind is doing and expressing, and that you are the one in charge of, is this really authentic? Where did it come from? Am I ready for a change? And if it comes from you, then this is sustainable development and growth, not imposed from the outside.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So I have one more question for you, and that is, how is it that moving your body can make you happier as well as healthier?
I'm almost tempted to say moving your body can't make you anything but happier and healthier. healthier, you've probably covered a lot. How it makes you happier, you know, there's a simple physiological level of gets circulation going, you know, it gets you breathing more, your cheeks get flushed. I love folk dancing because you're bouncing on your feet. And I'm working a lot with trauma patients now with the concept of resiliency. And I know when I used to jog or when I jump, I feel light. I feel like I can bounce back. Versus when you're depressed, you sort of shuffle your feet and everything feels heavy and you can't really leave the earth. You're kind of earthbound. And jumping is related to the imagination and the ability to get out of this kind of everyday world into the world of the imagination. So it expands your horizons. And another thing I forgot to say is that there's more research now on the mirror neurons, and we attune to each other. Now, in folk dancing, it's deliberate because everybody's doing the same steps and lines and circles and so fast that you don't have time to think. So, A, it gets you out of your story, and you're really focusing on the feeling of everybody else's hands in the circle so you don't get behind or in front of other people. You're harmonizing with them. And there's such joy in being part of a group, in the kind of community building where you're not alone anymore. And I think in the old days, they had a lot of ways of overcoming the kind of loneliness we see today. Everybody in their own little orbit or plugged into their own little machines or sitting in their own little cubicles, you know. So attunement and being with others on some, and we are social creatures. So that happens through the body just naturally, and we have to almost restore that function. I think we've lost a lot of it by the mechanized way we all live today.
Dr. Eileen, it's so wonderful talking to you. I could listen to you all day. before we close, would you like to talk about the gift that you're offering to our listeners?
Thank you. Yes, and I think we put a link on the website, and you're linking to it. I wrote a 3-volume series called Whole Person Healthcare, and 2007. Prager. And what I've done is I've taken at least my introduction to one of the volumes. It was also the preface, the foreword by Dean Ornish and David Spiegel, and put a little bit of the introduction to the arts movement and health, really cross culture and historically. And then I have another little section on how to move from a toolkit book that I developed on movement, which is sort of some mindful exercises and how to start becoming aware of your own movement style.
That's great. I hope everyone takes advantage of that. And with that, we're going to close for today. Thank you so much, Dr. Eileen. I hope I get the pleasure of interviewing again soon.
Thank you, Yolanda. It's been great.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.